16-bit Genesis system by Sega. Genesis does it all.
Hey, you.
This good. Thanks, Sega.
Hello, and welcome to an extra special episode of The Sega Guys. For those that don't know me, I'm Dan. And with me, as always, is James. How are you doing, James?
I'm very well. Thank you very much. Yourself?
Yes, very good, mate. Very good. Thank you very much. And very excited about a special episode that we've got planned for our listeners tonight. We've got a special guest with us. He is a true Sega legend, he having played a large part in the rise of the Sega Genesis and the creation of Sonic the Hedgehog. He's also featured prominently in the book Console Wars and the recent CBS documentary of the same name. To join us today is the former head of global marketing for Sega of America. It's Al Nielsen. Al, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's an absolute honour. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, and it's my pleasure.
Good stuff. I say thank you very much for joining us, Al. It's a real pleasure to have you on the show. So I guess we'll just kind of get straight into things then. So you were introduced on Console Wars as a gamer, you know, or the guy to ask about games. So how did you get into gaming, and what was the first game you played?
First game goes back, I guess, till Pong. And so, yes, I am that old. So
we're all catching up.
So it's going back to the beginning. You know, wish I could say Space War, which would even predate Pong, but that's okay.
And do you find much time to play today? You know, or do you ever find yourself going back to any of the kind of classic Sega systems to this day?
I play a lot of the Sega Genesis Mini with my grandniece, and so having a lot of fun on that. And nothing like the old Sega Genesis, Sega Mega Drive games.
I know, there really isn't. It's nice to hear that you're sharing those memories. So does she enjoy it?
Oh, she loves it, and she's a big Sonic fan.
See, my two-year-old, she'll be three in March, and again, it's the Mega Drive that she's getting started on. And it's just now she's got a bit of a kind of tendency. She likes the pause button or the start button. That seems to be the kind of go-to. But she loves her Disney cartoons. So like Aladdin, The Lion King, and obviously the Sonic games are kind of big favourites of her as well. So it's an ideal starting point, I think, to kind of keep the Sega legacy alive.
Oh, absolutely. They are Sega classics.
Yeah.
And they're classics in gameplay overall, so.
Yeah, I find it as well with my kids. They find it really easy. Sonic's such an appealing character, so they've all experienced Sonic, and they all love him, love the recent movie, and they play the classics as well, so there's definitely that appeal there. But how did you get into the gaming industry, Al? I mean, I know you worked a few roles in the shopping industry before, but if you could just tell us how you got into the gaming industry, or how your career started, really.
My career started out of college as a buyer for the JCPenney stores and catalogs. And one of my responsibilities was video games. And this was back in the Atari and Television and then eventually the ColecoVision days. So took them to become the largest retailer of video games in the U.S. And then I ended up being recruited into Mattel to work on Intellivision. And then over the years, I've worked on a variety of different things, from some products that console that didn't get out, come into the marketplace with Hasbro, then working with Sega.
Wonderful. So
that's a 30-year career in 20 seconds.
So you were at Mattel. Did you cross paths with Tom Kalinske then? Or?
Oh, absolutely. I actually had met Tom before then when I was at JCPenney, but worked with Tom when I was at Mattel.
Oh, wonderful. So how did your role in Sega first come about then?
I was recruited, and I got a phone call from a executive recruiter, and went into her office in San Francisco. She sat me down in a chair, then went over to a bookcase, took one of these big camcorders, you know, the big ones that weighed about 20 pounds and you put on your shoulder, and pointed it to me, pointed it at me, started and said, "The interview has begun." And I'm going, "What? Wait, what's going on here?" And she says, "Well, the interview is being done for Sega in Japan, and we're taking all the videotapes and sending them to Japan, and they'll decide who they want to go and meet with." And so it was the strangest interview I ever had, but I got the job, and I got a fantastic career and lots of great memories and lots of great friends out of it. So nothing to fault by that. A VHS tape made my life.
Wow. quite the story.
Yeah, it was different.
Especially compared to today. You know, you think of people going on job interviews today and Zoom calls and team calls, you know, old school. Mm-hmm. Old school.
Oh, very, very old school.
So, I mean, when you came to Sega, Al, you know, the Master System was already losing the battle against the NES, you know, and despite that, you know, many of the same celebrity endorsed titles like Joe Montana, Mickey Mouse, Moonwalker, they all came to the Master System. Was there ever an attempt or a notion on your part or Sega's part, you know, or the team's part, to push that console in the US as like an entry level system, you know, as it had been, you know, quite successful in Europe in its later years? Or was your focus when you came in just Genesis?
Well, when I came on in 1989, the Master System was being sold by Tonka Toys. It wasn't being sold by Sega.
Yeah.
So we didn't have control over it. And actually, when I joined Sega of America, it was our office was a repair center for Master Systems in the back. And there were about four of us who were brought on board to go and launch this new gaming system because Sega wanted to take back kind of their own future, starting with 16-bit. So we didn't get the rights to the Master System back until probably late 1990, early 1991. Paul Rio negotiated those with it. So by that time, we were very much down the road working with Genesis and things such as that. But when we took it back, we hired a director of marketing to go and oversee the Master System, Bob Botch, and had him go and run with it. And we were able to go and lower the price on that. But it was still very much at that time a 16-bit business because Genesis, of course, was in the market and the Super NES was coming in a few months or whatever the time frame was. So the Master System was a value system, but it wasn't something as highly promoted because the major promotion was on the 16-bit area. In terms of what you were talking about, in terms of celebrities and licensing, when we would go out and either negotiate deals with celebrities such as Michael Jackson or Joe Montana, or whether we were going to be licensing a property such as a Disney property or a movie, we would want to go and, you know, be able to go and manufacture games or make games for a variety of platforms because of Sega's global reach. And so as well as in markets, Master System was very, very strong while it wasn't as strong in the U.S. So we wanted to go and be able to go in and spread the licenses around. And so we would work with our affiliates around the world to go and say, is this a license or that you'd be interested in? And primarily the licenses, with the exception of Michael Jackson, because the celebrities didn't necessarily have as much of a global reach.
Yeah, because, I mean, the thing with, you think about the Genesis is that in the kind of modern era, the PlayStation gets a lot of credit for being the console which took gaming down a very lifestyle route. But I think if you kind of track back a bit to, you know, Genesis Mega Drive, it definitely did seem to be like a kind of change of tact. You know, like gaming had gone away from being for the kids. And was that, again, was that a kind of conscious decision you guys made on your part that you're going to target older gamers? You know, you knew what you had to do to take share away from Nintendo, but you were focused. Well, guys like Joe Montana, you're appealing to, you know, obviously adults with American football. Michael Jackson, at that time, global superstar. So, again, is that something you think back on and go, you know, maybe PlayStation wasn't the kind of the roots of you know, lifestyle gaming. You know, maybe the genesis in you, with what you did, you kind of started that path that gaming would take to kind of where it is just now.
Well, first of all, I don't think I'm ever a person who will say that the PlayStation was the start of lifestyle gaming. and I really do bring it back to Sega and Genesis, because we really transformed what the video game business was.
Yeah.
Prior to that with Nintendo, Nintendo's focus was very, very much on 9 to 12-year-old boys. And, you know, Nintendo had publicly stated, that's who our market is. That's what we care about. If we get girls involved, if we get teenagers, if we get, you know, young adults, that would be great. But 9 to 12-year-old boys was their target market. And so when I was preparing the marketing plan, it was like, okay, we really aren't going to go and go straight against the NES system, one, because of their tremendous market share, two, because they had $10 worth of marketing dollars or more for every dollar that I had. And so it's just hard to get a share of voice in the marketplace. So it made sense to go after an older audience. But there were, we also went and found that there were a lot of people who had, you know, kind of put their NES systems away in the closet. They aged out of it, and they weren't playing the NES much, if at all, anymore. They were in the arcades, which was a great Sega bastion. And so we wanted to go and be the system that could go and help take video gaming back into the mainstream. You know, it's kind of going back to the Atari 2600 days, when Space Invaders really helped to go and get people, you know, playing video games more and more. And so, you know, that was something that we went and very much did. We went and did promotions on college campuses. Tom Kalinske talks a lot about the college ambassador program that he started on college campuses, because we wanted to go in and appeal to a broader audience. And our sports games, you know, starting off with Tommy Lasorda baseball and Arnold Palmer golf, and then later Joe Montana football, Mario Lemieux hockey, David Robinson basketball, and on, Van Hollyfield boxing. And so, you know, we wanted to go and broaden the marketplace, and we were very successful at it. And so, you know, if you want to talk about creating a lifestyle brand, that was Sega. Mm-hmm. You know, definitely something that we did. And the others followed on our tails.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely brilliant. We can see that from, especially from when we watched the Console Wars documentary. It's something that I hadn't really given much thought of before, but when watching the CBS documentary and seeing Nintendo in its, you know, in at the height of its powers, when it was appealing to that their target audience, it was all toy stores, it was all young boys. It just shows how, you know, it was a masterstroke really going for that older audience, or that broader audience, as you say, Al. It's just fantastic stuff to see. But you were with Sega from the very beginning of the Genesis, as you said, and you at the beginning, you know, in those early in '89, you weren't just facing Nintendo. Now, obviously, they had an iron grip on the market, but you had NEC's Turbo Graphics come into the market as well, the TurboGrafx 16. Was it difficult to convince retailers to back the Genesis? I mean, given the huge retail clout of Nintendo, how did they respond when you were trying to pitch this new Sega console to them?
Well, it it was hard to a certain extent because of the massive power that retail power that Nintendo had, and how much pure profit they were bringing to retail stores. And there were also concerns in retail that if you did anything, you know, that Nintendo thought was a slight, you possibly could go and be risking your allocation. You know, oops, all of a sudden the truck, you know, went off the road and you didn't get your NES systems or you didn't get your hot games. And, you know, you laugh, but it was very much something that was out there in retail. And if you read Console Wars, you know, it tells it wonderfully about our trying to get into Walmart, the largest retailer in the United States, and how they didn't want to do anything that would go and upset Nintendo until we literally took over Bentonville, Arkansas, their headquarters, and turned Bentonville into Segaville, where you couldn't walk, you know, in any direction without going and seeing a Sega Genesis sign. And we had a free arcade located a few blocks from their headquarters where people would come, including Walmart employees, I'm sure, on their lunch hours to come and play Sega Genesis for free. And at football game, University of Arkansas football games, et cetera. And it was tactics like that that helped us get into Walmart finally. But back in the early days, you know, it was hard. One of the things we did at our head of sales and myself in, I guess, was April of 89, was meet with some of the key retailers to say, could we, you know, here's what we have to offer. Here's our plans. And, you know, we'd like you to go and take us. And the reaction overall was good. We were, you know, we wanted to get in and into retail, get our foot in the door, so to speak. We weren't asking for half the retail shelf space that Nintendo had, because we knew that if we could get ourselves in the door, we'd be able to go and stay and be able to expand. And so overall, those were good meetings prior to our launch at the June Consumer Electronics Show. But one retailer, I still remember him to this day, went and said, you know, I like what you're doing, but, you know, there's NEC out there and they've got this beautiful video and wow, this brochure that they've got, you know, it's gorgeous. What a wonderful video and brochure, you know. They're going to eat your lunch. And, you know, so our VP of sales, Dave Rhodes, when it said, but you're still going to carry us, go, yeah, but on December 26th, you know, I'm just going to go and return to you all of your unsold systems. Oh, that's okay. That's fine. You know, day after Christmas. And needless to say, on the day after Christmas, we weren't the system that got returned to the vendor. It was the other guy. And, you know, it was, you know, it's, we really didn't focus much attention on NEC because we were very focused on just what we were doing and let's go and get out there. We were focused on the customer and the consumer, and, you know, put us in great stead. And we walked out of, you know, 1989 being the number one 16-bit video game system in the U.S., and something we maintained.
Yeah, it's amazing, really. I mean, that you were pretty much head-to-head. I mean, didn't they release something like 2 weeks in between each other? So that really
one day.
Was it one day? Wow.
Yeah, I mean, we announced August 15th as our day. And then amazingly, they announced that their launch was going to be on August 15th. Anytime we would go and announce something, they would announce the exact same thing. We're going to be in malls. Oh, a week later, hey, no, we're going to be in malls. You know, and so we launched on August 14th, just so we could go and be a day ahead of them and be the first 16-bit system in the marketplace. I think that was the only time we reacted to something that they did, was just to be out there a day early. But it was, it was not something we were concerned about. We were concerned about establishing ourselves, and we knew that we had to go and establish, you know, a strong beachhead and grow it so that we would be in a good position for when the next 16-bit system from Nintendo would come out, named TBD, because we didn't know it at that time. But that was our plan. So we really weren't looking as much towards NEC.
Great. So, I mean, it's amazing that they sailed so closely to each other, and then all of a sudden the Genesis just pulled away so far ahead. The sights were on Nintendo. But was there a turning point? Obviously, you were fighting an uphill battle against Nintendo. Was there a point when you really started to believe that Sega couldn't just challenge Nintendo, but actually eat up their market share?
I think that the big deciding point was really, you know, the introduction of Sonic, and which was going up against the launch of Super NES. And Sonic was, you know, our secret weapon. Going back to when I first saw it on a developer screen at Sega Japan in action, and I had never seen, you know, a video game move so fast, and then they showed me these beautiful backgrounds, and it was like, this is something special. And as we started getting builds of gameplay in, it was great. And that's kind of when we put a lid on talking about Sonic. Sega Japan wanted to go and, you know, show it off and show all the gameplay off. And it was something that, you know, we had to go and appeal to the president of Sega overall to go in and not publicly show it. We just showed the title screen at the Tokyo Game Show, great animated title screen where Sonic comes up through the center and then wiggles his finger. So because we didn't want anyone really to know what this was, you know, and it was easy in the U.S. because also nobody had any idea what a hedgehog was, which made it even easier. that was the big thing. And, you know, at the June Consumer Electronics Show in 1991, was the first time we really went all out with Sonic and announcing it to the press, and then doing side-by-side comparisons with Sonic on Genesis and Super Mario on Super Famicom, because we had systems from Japan. And, you know, it was, as we like to say, Super Mario paled in comparison. Sonic was so much, the graphics were so much brighter, the colors were so much more vibrant. And, you know, there's a bit of a speed difference between a plumber and a hedgehog named Sonic. That was really the amazing start of everything. And we just had a great year. And then, we started working on Sonic 2. And Sonic 2 is what, you know, really put us ahead and gave us, you know, the number one market share head-to-head against Nintendo. Sonic was a big part of it. But it was also the rest of the other games, Toe Jam and Earl, Echo the Dolphin, Joe Montana's Sports Talk Football, Michael Jackson's Moonwalker, Streets of Rage, Streets of Rage 2. They all came together because we were something for, we had a game for, you know, kind of every interest that was out there. So it really coalesced into Sega becoming a great brand. And then, of course, our fabulous advertising and marketing.
Yeah, and that takes us on very nicely to the next question. You were talking about that marketing and advertising. Every Sega fan is more than familiar with the now famous Genesis Does What Nintendo Don't But in the UK, we had a very different kind of focus in terms of advertising. We had the barber and the cyber razor cuts. I mean, tell us a little bit about, obviously, the Genesis Does What and 10 Don't commercial, but did you have any influence at all over the cyber razor cut that we got in Europe?
Not at all. No. Each country was being run as its own separate division.
Right.
And, you know, we would, we you know, have meetings with Sega Europe, you know, several times a year, and we would see what they'd be doing and they'd see what we were doing. But there wasn't really any coordination on an advertising standpoint until we were getting ready for Sonic 2. And at that time, it wasn't so much we were coordinating advertising, but since it was going to be a worldwide simultaneous launch, we had a, I called a global meeting of all of the groups and said, let's talk about what we're going to do with this. Let's talk about what our promotions are going to be, what our advertising, what types of materials. And it's not that we want to go and have one size fits all advertising or marketing or anything like that. But if there's things that we like that another group is doing, you know, we're all free to go in and borrow from that or go on to that. If there's some artwork or displays, we can go and share in that. Not only being cost effective, but also, you know, that shares great ideas. But in terms of, you know, the actual advertising, you know, it's what works right for your market is what works right for your market. And that's how it is. Now, going back to the Genesis Does What Nintendo Don't commercial, and I still can't believe that after all these years we're you know, talking about an advertising campaign. Our goal was we wanted to go and really get out the difference between what Genesis was and what at that time NES was. And for people who hadn't yet experienced it or seen it. And so we gave that brief to our advertising agency, Bozell Jacobs, and they went away and came back a couple of weeks later, and we went and met with them. And they took us through the storyboards and, you know, explained what the sound of that it was going to be a song and what the deep voice of the announcer was going to go and be. And they took us through the individual things, and they, you know, you'd see Joe Montana football, you know, you can't do this on Genesis Does. You know, then you can't do this on Nintendo. Genesis Does, you can't do this on Nintendo, and takes you through all these different games. And you'd see, you know, Joe Montana there looking at the camera wearing a Sega jersey, Evander Holyfield, you know, putting up his boxing glove up in the air in triumph, and other cuts, Michael Jackson from the Moonwalker video, interspersed with Genesis cuts. And so it was there. And then they pull out one last storyboard and hand it, hold it up. And all it says was, I think they said Genesis Does, and then it's what Nintendo Don't. And we kind of fell on the floor just laughing. but it was just, it was so perfect. And it was like we just loved it, and then they showed us how it would look in print magazines, where you'd have you'd turn to a page and it would just be a black page with white type. Genesis Does, and then you'd open it up with what Nintendo and across the top, and then all the copy, and it just made a great statement. It helped go and show the difference between the two in a very strong way. And because of the song and because of the play on words, it was something that you internalized and you said, you know, you thought it was really cool. I don't think Nintendo thought it was too cool. And I'm sure that there were some very diehard Nintendo fans who weren't too happy with it. But I think that, you know, the average video game player, no matter what their system liked, just loved to play on words that was there. And 30 odd years later, we're still talking about it. You know, and I hear about it all over the world. And of course, you know, Genesis was only in the U.S. It was Mega Drive around the west of the world.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was just a campaign from, you know, the little old U.S. of A. So, and it went worldwide. and it's just amazing. So it's we're excited that, you know, people are still talking about it, and we're excited that people are still talking about what we did back then and all of the games that were there. You know, Tom Kalinske and I were talking, you know, I think 2 days ago, and it was like we always keep saying, he goes and says, I still can't believe that people are still interested in what we did, you know, and that they're just loving retro gaming. And retro gaming is, you know, really the capital R. Or we are the ones who are a big part of what retro gaming is all about.
Yeah, I mean, because like the whole Sega Nintendo thing, obviously today, you know, Nintendo are still about, and sadly, as much as we hate it, you know, obviously Sega are very different to what they were back then. But, you know, it's almost kind of got quite boring now. You know, it's the same three companies and has been for a long time. Gaming, I think it's got quite kind of iterative. I know as I've kind of got older, and as much as I do enjoy, you know, primarily I play on Xbox, but I have owned PlayStations down the years. But the main consoles that I still play to this day are Mega Drive, Saturn, and Dreamcast. That's the kind of go to, you know.
That's why you're the Sega guy.
There you go. Indeed. Perfect. But I mean, it is quite interesting. You're saying that we're talking about this 30 years later, but I think there's just a certain age group that, you know, with the age we were then and what we are now, and, you know, my wife calls it a midlife crisis. I don't know if that's true, but we obviously we're kind of keeping this whole thing going, keeping it alive, this kind of generation that kind of started with it.
I think that that's true, but from what I see and what I hear about, it's people who live through that, but it goes beyond that. It's really every age in between, because once they've you know, experienced you know, these classic games and these classic Sega games, you know, it makes them want to go and play the retro games.
And you see that as well on Twitter. You know, there's as you talked about different age groups, there's so many, you know, different, you know, retro based accounts now, and it is people that are in their teens or 20s that are picking these games up. So yeah, well, may it continue.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's like my son, when Console Wars, the CBS show, actually came onto television in the UK, we watched it, and we watched it with my teenage son, who absolutely loved it. One of his first games was Sonic the Hedgehog. So it just shows that whole, there's a certain feel to Sega, I think, especially Sega of that era. And I think that still translates down. And if you experience those games, if you see what Sega was about back then, there's a certain magic to it. And I think that, yeah, it's just absolutely timeless.
I also think that the Sonic movie from last year really, you know, helped to go and put a new emphasis on, or a new appreciation for Sonic, and having people want to go back and play the old games and see where it all started out.
Absolutely, and it was great that the film was so well received, especially with the old 16-bit sort of credit scene as well. So yeah, probably created a whole new wave of Sonic fans, at least, and Sega fans by extension. So it's great to see that sort of stuff still gains traction. But when we think back to that era in gaming and everything that you did personally and as a team to contribute to gaming, is there anything that you're most proud of when it comes to the Genesis or the Mega Drive?
You know, there were so many things that, you know, I look back on. I look back on what we went and, well, like I go back to your building a lifestyle brand. You know, I remember when we were trying to start a rating system, and Tom approached the Motion Picture Association of America, who were in charge of ratings for movies, and about could we go in and use a version of their rating system since it was so well known. And the response was, oh, no, you're just video games. You know, we're the movies. And, you know, Today the video game industry is bigger than the music and movie industry combined. So it's, you know, it's how we were able to go and, you know, create an industry that just had such great growth. Personally, you know, it was what we were able to go and do with Sonic Tuesday and Sonic 2 and just making it such a phenomenon, not in the U.S., but globally. And back then, you know, starting and today, street dates are commonplace. Back then, you didn't have street dates because of how products got shipped and things like that. And so, you know, that was a personal fond memory. And then not something that I'm proud of, but something that I fondly remember is just the great team that we had. And well, I'm proud to be able to have worked with all of them. You know, it was together we went and created magic, and you couldn't go and say, no, it can't be done, because somehow we'd figure out how to go and do it. And, you know, we're still friends to this day. So, you know, it's just a wonderful time in my memories, both personally and professionally.
Fantastic. So, I mean, that takes us on very nicely to, you know, Sonic himself. You know, we've kind of touched on him a wee bit there. Several games obviously launching. They've talked about the movie as well. But, I mean, obviously you're kind of renowned, Al, as being the father of Sonic. You were heavily involved in the, you know, the genesis, pardon the pun, of Sonic as a character, even choosing the mascot himself. So can you tell us a little bit about how that design evolved from the very first ones that you saw?
Certainly. And I won't take on the title Father of Sonic. I owe that to Yuji Naka, Ishihara-san, and the rest of the Sonic team. Because, you know, without the game and without the character, we wouldn't have anything to go and do that. You know, Sonic, well, when I first saw Sonic, it was just on a piece of paper. And it was Sonic and his rock band and his human girlfriend named Madonna. So that was one major change. You know, we went and said, you know, I said, I love Sonic. Well, it was, I had two choices, Sonic and this chicken and an egg. And so Sonic was the one that seemed to have greater appeal, but I had no idea what the gameplay was, at the time when choosing which one to go with. It was go with that character, but get rid of the human girlfriend and get rid of the rock band. And also all of these animals that were playing in the rock band. You may have seen some of the drawings that have surfaced from over the years of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was things. He was... you know, very similar to what he is today. We went and kind of rounded his edges, and not necessarily rounding in terms of, you know, physically rounding the graphics, but making it feel a little bit softer, a little bit more approachable, and, you know, allowing his personality to go and shine through. in some other earlier iterations, he did have fangs. And so that was something we talked to SOJ about and were able to get out of the way, because we wanted well, we knew that in order for it to become the icon of Sega and have major success in the U.S., we needed to have a character that was embraced by men, women, boys, and girls of all ages. And the fangs were giving it a little too much of an edge. And luckily we had, you know, one of the best character people in the universe, Tom Kalinske, you know, who goes back from his days in Mattel with a Barbie and Masters of the Universe, She-Ra, He-Man, etc., as well as lots of other characters. And so Tom, you know, helped tremendously in helping us go and define, you know, the character. And so the end result, you know, was just magic. I mean, it was a wonderful game and a character that the world could love.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he's still my favorite video game character of all time. It's funny you mentioned, because I know when you're talking about the various early forms of him, I've seen the Rock Band and I've seen Madonna, and I've seen the version of him that's got all the he's got, you know, he's got numerous bites rather than the trademark quills that he's got now, or the trademark haircut, so to speak. I don't think I've ever seen him with the fangs though, so I'd like to see that at some point.
Yeah, that one has, those graphics have disappeared. and because there's a lot of people who denied that he ever did have fangs, and oh yeah, he did. And so it's what can I say? We know it. We saw it. We fought for it. I probably have the faxes someplace talking about the fangs, but I don't have the actual graphics. So anyway, but that was then, this is now.
Yeah, I'd love to see it at some point, so hopefully they resurface.
But oh, I don't think they will.
It's like a best kept secret now.
It never happened. Yeah, yeah, it never had. There's groups who want to say it never happened, so yeah.
Do you remember how the game was first received when it was first unveiled to the public? Was it all positive? I mean, I know that there was eventually a huge furore around it, but was it just a full and generally good reception all around?
Oh, it was a great reception. It, you know, it instantly went to our top product, you know, it amongst Sega Genesis owners, and it also went and sold a lot of hardware, Sega Genesis consoles. So people were buying Genesis and switching from other systems to go and be able to have Sonic. It also had a great reception from the press, both the gaming press and financial press, traditional lifestyle press. Oh, there's that lifestyle word again. Traditional newspapers, TV shows, etc. So it was something that people loved. They loved when, you know, you would pause the game and you'd watch Sonic cross his arms and then just start tapping his toe and show that he had an attitude. You know, it was Sonic really helped sell himself, both by his character and his great gameplay.
Amazing. So, I mean, Sonic obviously beat the Super NES to market, you know, and by that time that the SNES had landed, you know, as you said, he was a massive fat. He was, you know, selling systems on his own. But, you know, despite that, did you have any concerns whenever obviously the Genesis's main rival appeared. I remember a scene in the Console Wars documentary, and I'm not sure if it was attributed to yourself, Al, you can correct me on that, but did you get a hold of a Super NES on import? And it was at that point you seen it and realised, you know, well, we've got more than this has to offer?
What Sega Japan, when the Super Famicom came out in Japan, and I don't know if they camped out in stores overnight or whatever, from what I heard, they were able to get three systems, and they kept two for themselves, and they sent one to us. And so they overnighted, air freighted it to us, and we set it up in Tom's conference room and, you know, turned it on. And, you know, we expected, you know, angels to start singing and, you know, all things, because this was the Super Famicom coming up, and, you know, started playing Super Mario World. And it was classic Super Mario. You know, the graphics were a little bit bigger. It wasn't as bright and vibrant as Sega Genesis, and definitely as Sonic. And I kind of called it 12-bit. You know, it wasn't up to what Genesis was doing in 16-bit. And, you know, it's the first title out of the gate. And 8-bit. So I thought 12-bit. It was kind of a middle ground. So, you know, initially we felt good. You know, played it some more and, you know, still felt good. But then we were talking and I said, you know, to Tom, I want to go head-to-head against Nintendo with this. And he said, okay, prove it, you know, that it's better. And so we held some secret playtest groups across the country where we recruited both Mega Drive Genesis owners as well as NES owners, and we wanted the majority to be NES owners, because we knew we had to go and convince NES owners that Sonic was great. And then we said, not only do we want a majority, I think it was 80% NES owners, we want the majority of those, and I think it was 90% of those owners, to be people to say that Mario is one of their top three favorite games or characters, that they had to love him. Because if we could go and get Mario lovers to choose Sonic, then we knew we had a winner. And so we set up systems with both Super Famicom with Mario and Sega Genesis with Sonic, and bring the people in, let them go and play. And first they'd play one, and then they'd play the others. Half the people started off on Sonic, half the people started off on Super Famicom. And which was great, because they had never seen Sonic before, and they had never seen the 16-bit Nintendo system before. And then we asked them, which did they prefer, which one would they want to buy, and which was their favorite. And it was like 87-90% chose Sonic over Mario. Wow. And, you know, it was amazing. And so it was like, okay, yes, this confirms that we've got a winner and we can go head-to-head against Super Nintendo. And we started out in the Consumer Electronics Show in June of 91, which I mentioned, where we had the two monitors, one on top of each other, one playing Super Famicom with Mario and the other playing Sonic the Hedgehog. And we asked people to go and compare. And then what we did, since Super Nintendo wasn't going to be available at retail and people wouldn't have seen it except in, you know, game magazines, that we would go and help introduce the system for Nintendo, because, you know, we're nice people and we're happy to go and do that. And so we did a mall tour throughout the country, and up on the, and, you know, we had about 40 systems set up with all the save games. And up on the stage, we had Genesis systems and Super Famicom systems playing Sonic and Super Mario World. And we had people play them both and then go and vote for which one they thought was the best. And it was, no market had less than an 85% preference for Sonic, and the largest preference for Sonic over Mario was in Seattle at a mall 5 miles away from Nintendo's headquarters, which was fabulous. And, you know, one member of the press went and said, oh, come on, you're just going to go and put down whatever number you want. And so said, hi, why don't you come and be our election judge and you go and count the votes? Because, you know, we're just that confident. And, you know, we knew that once you experience them both, just the sound, the graphics, the speed, the attitude of Sonic would just come through. You know, it wasn't a hard decision to go in and go head to head between the two games. We were that confident because we had done the research.
I can just imagine inside the boardrooms of Nintendo, they must have been they must have been cursing you guys upside
down. they came and visited us. The Nintendo game counselors came, and they were wearing their really nice, beautiful embroidered Nintendo game counselor jackets, and they'd walk through our exhibit in a mall trying to get noticed, and they just got ignored. And the VP of marketing paid a visit and just kind of watched from a distance what was going on. And I'm sure he wasn't too happy. But, you know, all's fair in love and video gaming.
Absolutely. I mean, is it the same show that you mentioned before where I think it was in Console Wars, I think it's you who someone said, oh, the Super Nintendo has 12 million colors. What have you got? And you point them to Sonic the Hedgehog and say, how many colors does that have?
It was at the Consumer Electronics Show in June 90, where we did the head to head. And the guy had just come from the Nintendo press conference right before, which was held right before the doors to the show opened. And Nintendo, you know, said why they're so great and why this new system is great. You know, never mentioning the competition, because the competition doesn't exist, because video gaming was only Nintendo. Mm. And they talked about the specs, and the guy comes up and says, you know, Super Nintendo has 32,765 colors. You only have 512. What are you going to do about it? his exact words. And I silently just walked him over, you know, to the display. And I said, which one has 32,000 colors? And he just skulked away. and he was from a major national magazine. You know, it was like, okay, I'm sure Nintendo wants to tell you what to do, but the proof of the pudding is in the gameplay, to mix two metaphors there.
Absolutely amazing. I mean, Sonic 1 was so successful. Obviously, a sequel had to be done. In many people's opinion, Sega outdid themselves in every respect. But as you were alluding to earlier, Sonic 2 was the first simultaneous worldwide release. I mean, it's something that we take for granted now. It's common for like major releases like your Call of Duties, your Assassin's Creed get worldwide releases. But so we take it for granted today. But, you know, Sonic Tuesday was the very first one. So how did this, you know, bold and innovative approach to launching a game across the whole world, how did that come about, and what challenges did you all face?
Well, you know, even, you know, going, forget about a global release, doing a street date alone in just one country was unheard of, because in those days, you know, a video game would be shipped from our warehouse, and most likely it would be going to the warehouse of a retailer like Toys R Us, who would then go and send it out to their stores. And depending on how close a store was to the various warehouses, it could take anywhere from 6 days to 2 or 3 weeks for a store to get it in stock. So there was no, somebody would go and put it on sale earlier. Somebody would, they put it on sale as soon as they got it. And, you know, there had been attempts to go and, you know, tell retailers to go and hold it back. But what would happen would be some mall, some retailer in a mall in, you know, Topeka would go and get it in and say, oh, I want to go and put this on sale right now. And so they put it on sale. And so then the store at the other end of the mall is going, hey, he's put Sonic on it. Joe, get it out of the back. We're putting it on sale now. And then the Toys R Us across the street. And then, you know, in the rest of the city. And then in the rest of the state. And finally, the store, the headquarters is saying, okay, put it on sale to every one of our stores. And street dates get broken. And so, you know, being able to go and do a street date in the U.S. was, you know, just unworkable, even though it was kind of the holy grail of video game marketing, because we couldn't start our advertising for something until, you know, a lot of the stores had it in stock, because the worst thing you want to do is get somebody excited about something and then they go to the store and it's not in stock. So, you know, it affected everything that we wanted to do. So we had Sonic 2. We knew it was going to be this great game from everything that we had seen. And Madeline Schroeder and I, Madeline was my product manager who was in charge of Sonic. We're working on the marketing plan for the for Sonic 2. And we knew the game was bigger and better. We wanted this program to be bigger and better than the marketing plan was for Sonic 1. And so we were pulling out all stops, and we had been working on it for about 3 months and getting ready for a presentation to Tom and the rest of the senior staff the next day. And finally, at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, we were done. And we had this plan, and it was probably 50 pages long, and just plenty of slides. No PowerPoint back then. We had, you know, overhead projectors and foils that, with all the stuff on it. Would have been so much easier if we had PowerPoint. And so, you know, looking at it, and we were just happy it was done. And I was saying, you know, this just doesn't, this isn't big enough. It's not good enough. And it's like, Al, we've done everything we want, you know, everything we've ever talked about, we put in. And it's like, no, it's not good enough. You know, it's got to be bigger. But it can't be bigger. And, you know, it was just like the nagging. And it's like, what can we do? And I'm keeping thinking, it's like, I want to do a street date. And it's like, how do we do a street date? And it's like, well, we're going to have to air freight them in so that they arrive the day before the street date, because that's the only way not to get the retailers to put it on sale, is to actually go and spend the money to go and do it. And it was so expensive to go and, you know, air freight a million cartridges to over 13,000 doors. And so it was like, okay, street date. And it's like, you know, if we're going to do that, why don't we just make it global? And I tell Madeline, and she just looks at me and goes, yeah, that is bigger. And And I think I used the term Sonic worthy. I said what we were doing first wasn't big enough. It wasn't Sonic worthy because, you know, we wanted nothing but the best for our friend. And so we literally rewrote our marketing plan that we had spent 4 months doing. And over the next 4 hours and changing everything around, we didn't throw out, you know, stuff that we had done, but we had to rejigger how it fit into the plan and doing this global launch and figuring out how we would go and pay for it, pay for all the air freight and everything like that. And, you know, then the next morning, Madeline and I presented, and I think we spoke for about an hour, and there was silence in the room. And finally, I said, "So what do you think?" And Tom just looks up, and he goes and says, to our VP of sales, "So Rich, what do you think?" Okay. and Rich goes and takes a deep breath and goes and says, "I don't know how we're going to pull it off, but we're going to have to." And that was it. Once that was said, it was just like everyone agreed, okay, we're going to figure out how to go and make this work. And so Paul Rio is calling in our head of operations to go and say, "Hi, you need to ship 1 million cartridges overnight to 13,000 retailers and make it no cheaper than doing it by truck. Talk to you later." And Shinobu says, "I'm going to go and call Makiyama in Japan and tell him, get him on board for the global launch." Tom goes, "I'm going to call Nick Alexander at Sega Europe, who's the president of Sega Europe, get him on board." And, you know, it just then became just a big sprint to get Sonic Tuesday underway. And, you know, then we, 3 months later in May, was the first time we had this major event where we brought 400 retailers down to Boca Raton, Florida, and to show our products for the coming second half. And we introduced Sonic 2 and Sonic Tuesday and said, "Here's what we expect you to do." And amazingly, and retailers don't like to be told what they're going to do. They like to tell you what you're going to do, which is fine. And they said they believed in what the promise of this was. And, you know, said, "Okay, we want to make this," you know, Toys R Us said, "We want to make this our number one product of the year." And the head of Toys R Us, the founder of Toys R Us, Charles Lazarus, you know, told his staff there, "You got to go and do whatever you need to do to make this number one." And, you know, the rest is history. But it was literally something that came about at the last minute.
I really hope the younger listeners, you know, the people who take Game Pass day one, download them the day it comes out, games to their hard drive, really listen to that story and appreciate the challenges that they used to go into launching games. That's an incredible story.
You know, it's really changed how video games are sold and marketed to this day. And you know, the whole Sega Genesis story from many, many different aspects has become a, you know, interesting business case. And there are business schools who are now teaching this as part of their MBA courses. There are people who are writing their master's thesis on Sega. And, you know, it's a great entertainment story, a great lifestyle story, once again, that word, but it's also a great business story.
Let's go back now to the 24th of November 1992 and listen to the words of Sega of America CEO Tom Kalinske as he launched Sonic 2 in North America.
Last Christmas, the world felt its first Sonic boom when Sonic the Hedgehog 1 sold more than 1 million copies and became the most popular video game of 1991. In fact, our Genesis unit is the most popular 16-bit game player in the United States, dominating the industry with over a 60% share of the market. And now that Sonic has a new friend, we believe Sonic 2 will be America's hottest video game this Christmas, and we project to sell more than 2 million copies in the United States between now and Christmas. Today, we have received word that Sonic 2 is already off to a very fast start. Sonic 2's sell-in in Europe will exceed 1.2 million units. It's been on the shelves in the United Kingdom for just today, and they just reported a complete sellout on the phone call into us here. I've also spoken to our folks in Japan. Sonic is causing an equal frenzy in that country, where Sonic has been available since yesterday. Now, right here in the United States, Sonic 2 is breaking all national sales records. It appears that more than 250,000 games are going to be sold today in the United States.
So, I mean, while Sega did have that cultural phenomenon in Sonic, obviously to sell the Genesis or Mega Drive, another phenomenon, and I think whenever you think of gaming at that era, this particular title, I think, is probably, you know, up there with any in terms of being a true cultural gaming phenomenon. As in 1992, Street Fighter 2 would come to the Super NES as an exclusive at that time, and it gave the console a shot in the arm. So, you know, how did Sega respond to such a massive title being an exclusive at that point? And did you see that game, you know, at Sega and immediately think, you know, we need a response to this on Genesis or Mega Drive?
Well, you know, it wasn't so much we were going in and, you know, looking at other titles and because we had to deal with what we had now. And but the other thing you have to remember is before Street Fighter II, there was Streets of Rage, you know, one of the original urban brawling games, or bare knuckle as was known in Japan, and that had become a phenomenal seller for us, and it also helped go and sell a lot of hardware and a lot of systems for us. Would we have liked Street Fighter II to also be on Sega Genesis? Certainly. You know, we wanted any good game to go and be on Sega Genesis. You know, part of it goes back to Nintendo going and, you know, if you're going to do it for Nintendo, you're not going to go and do it for other systems. And until that finally went and changed. But that's the way it was in the early days. But, you know, we would go with our best efforts and, you know, Streets of Rage 1 was great. Streets of Rage 2, which people is considered by many to be even a better game, almost didn't happen because Bare Knuckle wasn't as strong in Japan as it was. And so they had taken the team that was going to be on Bare Knuckle 2, Streets of Rage 2, and put them on another title. And so it was a lot of back and forth between myself and Tom and Sega Japan going, we need this. You know, this is going to be, you know, I think it was our number three title for the year in terms of volume. And I just can't easily replace it. Finally, they got assigned a team to it. But so many months had passed that the earliest we would have it in some stores was December 6th of 1992. So it really became a first quarter 1993 title for all intents and purposes. But that was great. We had a great title for the first quarter there. But you know, it's you go with you know, what you've got. You go and do a plan around what you think is going to be the best titles that you have, and we're working, you know, 18 months out or more from when we first start putting together a plan for a product line, and you know, going along the way, and the plan, you know, consistently changes. Sometimes titles go longer in their development, or sometimes a title which you think is going to be a AAA game all of a sudden becomes a B or B minus game, and so you know, have to go and change your marketing plans and your sales forecasts. But that's okay, because there's almost certainly a title that's going to be a B, which is going to become an A or an A plus or an A plus plus plus. And so, you know, it's always being nimble doing that. And the best thing is you have the best games for your customers.
Oh, absolutely. One thing that you touched on there, Al, was is how Nintendo operated in the market. And they certainly had a stranglehold on certain developers. I mean, you touched on Capcom being one of them. So there's games like Strider, Ghouls and Ghosts, Final Fight, which, you know, licensed by Sega and coded in-house because, you know, Capcom wouldn't develop for Sega systems themselves. So like many other third parties such as Konami, they were locked into licensing deals. Do you recall much about when Capcom did finally develop a game for the Sega Genesis? I mean, eventually they brought Street Fighter in themselves, which was kind of a watershed moment for Sega. Do you remember anything about that deal, or how we finally managed to get developers like Capcom on board?
You know, that was done between Sega Japan and Capcom. And so, you know, I really wasn't privy to it. You know, I would find out, or we would find out, you know, after everything was settled. But we weren't involved in the before the negotiations going up to it. So no. But you know, while Sega had a broad and strong first party business, and we would put out more first-party titles than Nintendo was, but that was just, you know, a different business approach. We wanted a strong third-party business because we weren't the sole, you know, developers of great titles. There were great titles from lots of different people. And so, you know, we wanted a strong third-party lineup.
Yeah, because we actually wrote a piece on our WordPress site just now. You're talking about you know, first party output, and it was actually all about, you know, Sega being possibly the most prolific first party publisher I think ever. You know, because I think Sega had a philosophy, especially in those days where Nintendo had, you know, a lot of franchises locked away and kind of license deals, where you would create your own version of games. You know, you touched on, you know, the Streets of Rage. You know, that was clearly influenced by Final Fight. And even to this day, Streets of Rage is now held in greater esteem than Final Fight. So, I mean, was that another kind of conscious thing that Sega did at the time, you know, to your knowledge, where you would look at it in early days and go, well, if we can't get that because Nintendo won't let them bring it here, then to hell with it, we'll just do it ourselves?
I don't think our goal was we can't have that, so let's do our own. You know, I probably the best example about that was, you know, how the development of Sonic, Mr. Nakayama, who is the president of Sega, wanted to go and have our icon And, you know, he wanted, quote unquote, our Mario. And so we went in to go and develop what our icon was. But there's no way you're going to go and say that Sonic is, you know, anywhere near shape or form of Mario. So it's a different approach from that standpoint. As part of product planning, you know, we're looking at what are categories that we're interested in. Sports, arcade, action, street fighting, fighting games, etc. And so therefore, you know, you want to go and have those in. You're looking at, you know, other titles that are there. On Toe Jam and Earl, there wasn't a big demand for the slowest characters in the universe. We made a game of that concept. Or there wasn't a thing about, dolphins are big, so we need a dolphin game. So, you know, Echo comes about. So you come out and you go and figure out what you think is going to be the best assortment of games. And you always have more ideas than you have development groups that you can go and possibly do, even though, as you said, we were much more prolific than other first party companies. There were also times when we would be approached by Sega Japan because there'd be a third party who was selling their game in Japan, but they didn't have US sales or marketing. And so would we be interested in taking the game on and distributing it for the U.S. marketplace? And we did that in a number of cases. You try to come out with a good assortment that's there. I don't think, you know, we were saying we need this. Okay, let's go and do our own version. And that happened a lot back in the Atari 2600 days. It really wasn't necessarily our approach.
Oh, brilliant. I mean, Sega really were one of the most innovative developers, certainly first-party developers, especially in our opinion. And they weren't stopping on hardware either. So obviously in 1991, the Mega CD launched in Japan, and then later in the US and Europe. Some say that it was developed just out of concern over the abilities of the TurboGrafx CD and the SNES because of the extra chips and special things that the SNES could do. How did Sega of America feel about the Mega CD? What were your thoughts about marketing the add-on at the time?
Well, we thought that, this was a feeling that I know was shared by both Sega Japan and Sega Europe, was that CD was where the industry was going to. And, you know, our hardware group had been working on CD, and they've worked on lots of different projects, lots that you never hear about. We were looking, towards CD becoming an important part. The other thing was about CD was, we could go and put, the same game on the system. We could add some new levels. We could, you know, do some better sound. Okay. Yeah. That's one way, but there's, you know, lots of different things that you can go and do with the capability and the storage of CD, as well as the capabilities of the hardware that you build around CD. And are they you know, it be kind of comes a whole new world. What is going to work from a development standpoint? What is going to go and work from a gaming standpoint? What is, you know, what kind of, how does adding video to something do it? How do you best incorporate the ability to go and add, you know, real music to it instead of working off of a chip? So there's lots of different pieces. And so we knew that there was going to be a tremendous learning curve that was coming. And it became we knew that Sega CD, Mega CD was going to be an important product, not just for sales or for what it could go and do for the brand, but also for how it is getting us ready for long-term future in CD-based games. It's how we're able to go and develop games that best utilize these capabilities while taking things that, nah, that doesn't work so well. You know, it's not something that makes for a great experience, not something that somebody wants, or technical decisions. So it really became a massive learning experience for us. And that's why one of the reasons we were excited about Sega CD, Mega CD coming out. And so, you know, that's kind of how we viewed it. At Sega of America, we built, you know, entire new R&D studios to go and prepare us for what could be done on CD. Whole new audio studios, bringing in major, you know, SGI, Silicon Graphics workstations at the time for developing new products. So we felt it was an important step in, you know, in the long-term growth of what Sega hardware and software was going to be.
It's amazing because, yeah, I mean, Sega's always been a forward-looking company when you really look back at, obviously, CD technology was where it's going, and you can even see that going even way up to the Dream, one of the first to use, have a built modem. So, yeah, it's amazing that that's Sega all the way through.
Uh-huh, absolutely. Yeah, it's, you know, we had a really strong hardware group who, you know, just kept looking at different things, and which is great. It's what you would expect from a company that was, you know, looking not just at today, but tomorrow.
Yeah, because in the years that would follow, you know, several years after the Mega CD, you know, there would be several, you know, rivals appearing, you know, the Atari Jaguar, the Commodore CD32, the 3DO, and then obviously Sega of Japan. I believe they intended the 32X or Project Mars to be a standalone system, but it was you guys, if I believe I'm right, as you suggested, that become an add-on for Genesis instead. So, I mean, what was the kind of approach towards the 32X? You know, was there any concerns elsewhere, considering that Saturn was already kind of on its way?
Well, first of all, I don't remember anyone at Sega of America saying, let's make 32X a standalone, let's make this system standalone.
Okay.
And in fact, the answer was, take it away. Get it out of my sight now. okay. It was because when we were, you know, looking at what we were doing, you know, we knew that there would eventually go and be a follow-up system to the Genesis. Okay. And which would be CD based, you know, and lots of different things that were being looked at in terms of architecture. The 32X was, you know, one of the potential architectures. But it's also, you know, what is the right time for it? Because we want to go and make sure that we, there's still a lot of life in Sega Genesis. A lot of more hardware that can go and be sold. And, you know, we just didn't want to cut and run to the next system. The other thing was, we knew that Sega CD was on our plate for 1992. That was, you know, an expensive add-on. And in fact, it was, with a retail price higher than the original retail price of the Genesis. And so we're asking you to buy a peripheral, which is costs more than the hardware. And by the time it came out, twice as much as the hardware was, Genesis system was going to cost. And then buying a whole new, software library to go along with it. And since it still was using attached to Genesis, we also still wanted to continue to selling Genesis cartridges and, you know, cartridge based games. So, you know, those were a lot of things in terms of what our plan was. And then also marketing dollars being allocated to Genesis as well as to Sega CD, and our resources internally being able to go and develop CD games and Genesis games, because you only have so many teams to be able to go and do things. And now you're going to go and bring on a new peripheral, which is expensive and everything else I just went and said, and was not offering, you know, a experience far beyond what you were having now. Plus, a person's going to say, okay, I've got $200 in my pocket. Am I going to buy a 32X or am I going to buy a Sega CD or am I going to buy 4 or 5 Genesis games? You know, and what's the difference between a 32X and a Sega CD? Why do I want one over the other? What? And you're just confusing the consumer. So it there were, you know, a whole bunch of reasons for us to go and say, no, this isn't something that we really want. You know, there was a lot of pressure from Sega Japan to go and go down the 32X road, you know. And so it wasn't something that, you know, we were looking forward to. That's about all I can say on that.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like a very busy time in 1993 from a hardware perspective, because obviously you've got those very early talks about the 32X, as we've been talking about, and then you've got the Saturn being developed in the background. You've also, I don't know if you're around for any other discussions with Sony when they came over, when they proposed to Sega of America that they wanted to do a joint venture with Sega. Do you have any memories of those discussions? Were you surprised when Nakayama-san dismissed the idea?
You know, all of us at Sega of America, it was definitely something that we were interested in. The idea of a Sega PlayStation, for want of a better name. You know, we knew great software. They were a great hardware company. bringing the two to go together. We had had a good relationship with them, working on the Sega CD, Mega CD. And so we thought that they were a great partner, and we thought that it was something that made sense. You know, it's unfortunately, it just didn't come to be when SOJ decided that it was not a path that we should go on. It would have been, I think, just a tremendous a product, and it would have been, you know, bigger and better, because you're just bringing these two great companies together. So it was unfortunate.
Yeah, because I think a lot of kind of Sega fans still look back to that moment as almost, and obviously Sony had also approached Nintendo and were also kind of, you know, knocked back in that regard as well by Nintendo. So it's almost as if being knocked back by the two biggest players in the game almost gave them like a chip on their shoulder, which I think for Sony, I still think carries through to this day, you know, with gaming. It's just whenever you look at how things went for Sega after the Dreamcast, and things could have been, you know, so much different. You know, if that one decision, a lot seems to kind of hinge in the history of gaming wise just on that one decision by both Nintendo and Sega to say no to Sony.
Yes, you know, it's the thing, you know, who knows when you say it could have been, it might have been. Do I think that it would have, at the time, it would have been a good decision? Yeah. You know, who knows what history would be, but I think it would have been it would have made for interesting times for Sega.
And do you feel that there was a little bit of animosity from PlayStation on that rebuttal? So almost like, if they don't want to partner with us, we'll show them. Kind of what comes to mind is the E3 299 line that's now infamous.
I think that Sony is a big corporation, and so there are lots of different groups within it. So I'm not sure how the group that was handling who was involved in the Sega, Sony, PlayStation were involved, as opposed to the people who were at Sony launching PlayStation. I have to remember that a bunch of the people who were at Sony in the Sony PlayStation unit were ex-Sega people. And so, you know, I think that they'd be excited to be able to go and, you know, show that they could one-up Sony, one-up Sega. So, you know, it's who knows? But,
yes.
But it's whole different groups of people.
Yeah, Steve Race is one name that comes to mind. I mean, he's quite prominent in the Console Wars documentary. So I think he was very much of the, you know, I think Nakayama did run a few people up the wrong way, and they did jump ship in the end. Or at least that's the sense that I got in a few regards.
Who knows?
No, so kind of last kind of question hardware wise before we kind of move on, Al. So I mean, there's a lot of debate in the community and online about who it was that wanted the Saturn out the gate first. So a lot of people say it was Sega of Japan who wanted to kind of pull the trigger early, and some say it was also maybe it was a bit down to Tom Kalinske, whether he decided he wanted to try and get an upper hand in the US and that kind of early launch. So I know you'd kind of departed a couple of years prior to the Saturn launching, but do you ever kind of take a look back and think they launched 3 months early, but then you see the quality of the titles that came out on the Saturn towards the end of 95 and at the start of 96 in Europe, talking primarily about Virtua Fighter 2, Sega Rally and Virtua Cop, which I think are renowned as being called the Big Three. And while Panzer Dragoon was an absolutely amazing launch title for the Saturn, when you see Sega Rally beside Daytona, the kind of the Sega fan in me just wishes that they had kind of went 3 months later instead of. And I think it kind of goes back to that point you made about being confident in what you've got. I think if you look at the games that they had coming up and had maybe left it 3 months later, you know, do you ever look at the Saturn launch and think, oh, if I'd been there, I might have done things a wee bit different?
If I had been there, would I have done things a bit different? I think that everybody at Sega of America, and as I say, everybody at Sega of America, did not want the launch when it was. It was not something that Sega of America, that Tom asked for. It was not something that we had planned or they had planned. Even when I was there, as we were doing long-term planning, it was not something that had planned in terms of it. You know, this was a decision that Sega Japan made as to when it would launch in the U.S. It impacted Sega of America in many ways. You know, from being able to sell more Genesis systems, more Genesis software. Being able to, you know, at that time, okay, Sega Genesis, Sega CD, Sega 32X, and, you know, the last thing that Sega needed, you know, on their plate, and to confuse consumers even more, was a whole nother system, and being able to do that. And, you know, hardware is, you know, hard. It's amazing. It's the first syllable of hardware. You spend a lot of time getting ready for a launch from a lot of standpoints, from a hardware standpoint, from a software standpoint, from a marketing standpoint, from a sales standpoint. I think it could have been a lot different if it hadn't been launched when it did.
Mm-hmm. No, because I always look at the, you know, the people who say, oh, there's, you know, various kind of forums and tweets and things, and people, oh no, Tom Klinsky wanted to go first. No, it was Sega of Japan. And when you watch Tom Klinsky doing the E3 in 1995 when he announces that launch, I've said to Dan many times that we've watched this, and that's a man that did not want to launch that system. So it's quite kind of, it's good to have officially, you know, confirmed there that it certainly was obviously Sega of Japan's call to go on the Saturn.
Thomas said it. You know, it's no big secret. Thomas said it. I believe it's in Console Wars. It's no big secret.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Yeah. So. You had so much success with Sega. As I say, you're a legend in our eyes, Al. But you parted ways with Sega officially in 1993. I mean, would you mind telling us what the reason was and why you left?
My job had changed to my global marketing role, and I was spending just so much time on a plane. You know, I'm still working off freaking flyer miles from 30 years ago. I'm not kidding. And I think I'm down to my last 500,000 miles. But, I love product. I love hands-on marketing. And my job had changed dramatically, and I was seeing flight attendants more than I was seeing my colleagues, and so it just was the right time for me to go and move on. But I still love the people. I still love Sega. Sonic's my good buddy, and so it's but it just happened. The circumstances just made it time for me to go on.
No, as I say, as Dan said, you are a Sega legend, a legend.
Well, thank you.
As well, Al. So thank you very, very much for joining us, and just kind of one final nice kind of bit of trivia to finish off, just a not Sega related, nothing about the past, just finally, if we came to your home right now, what would we find playing in Al Nielsen's disk drive, cartridge slot and hard drive?
There's nothing in my cartridge slot right now because I'm playing so much on the Sega Genesis Mini. So I haven't taken a cartridge out for a few months. So that was an easy one. Disk drive. Am I playing? And do I have anything that has games on it connected to a disk drive? Nothing that I'm playing right now. And I don't own an Xbox X or a PlayStation 5. I do have an Xbox One, but there's nothing in its drive right now. And what was the third part?
That was it, disk drive, cartridge slot, and hard drive. So what you're saying, Al, is it like us?
On my hard drive? Not playing much on hard drive right now. Hard drive, it's playing a lot of music, but that's about it.
So gaming wise, you're keeping it retro.
Now, right now I am. That doesn't mean that I don't play things of a more modern bent, modern generation bent. But right now I'm being a little retro.
Blowing.
Fantastic. What's your pick of the game? What's your main game then on the Genesis Mini? What brings you back again and again, or what brings you back the most?
I can't stop playing Sonic 2 just because it's that's there. If I just need to go and slow down, I'll play some Toe Jam and Earl, because nothing slows you down like Toe Jam and Earl. You have to remember, Sega is the company with the fastest characters and the slowest characters. We go literally from A to Z there. What else? Just a bunch of stuff. So it's taking them all in.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a big fan of Sonic 2 here. I mean, for me, it's my favorite game of all time, so it's a wonderful choice. But Al, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been an absolute pleasure. And for anyone that's not watching Console Wars or read the book, this, make sure you do so. But Al, just once again, thank you from myself and James.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So, a massive thank you once again to Al Nielsen for giving Dan and I almost 2 hours of his time to chat about his time at Sega. As we said, an absolute legend, not just at Sega but in gaming, for the legacy he and his team have given gamers. We hope you've enjoyed this episode as much as we've enjoyed recording it, and a reminder that you can follow the podcast account at Sega Guys, you can get myself at The Segaholic, and you can get Dan at Swooper_D. Thank you very much for tuning in, and for all your continued support as the podcast has just hit 2,000 unique streams in less than 10 months. So until next time, guys, thanks once again, take care, speak soon.